that. Yet Benjamin's notion is that we understand the writer as having a different role than that conceived by many, no doubt, in this audience. In his audience. The writer is not merely one who obeyed the strictures of a dogma or a religion in order to bring about an action. The genuine writer is one who would rename for his or her audience the relation between the poet and the world, audience and the world. Ramon Fernandez, whom Benjamin quotes in the epigraph to the essay, is the critic to whom Wallace Stevens, poet, speaker, and the idea of order, U.S., speaks of a female artificer of the world. Rich, in her latest collection of essays, which Bob referenced, tells us this poem was important for her precisely because it gave her a language in which she could conceive of the female maker. Is this the sort of alienation from the world as it is that Benjamin advocates? Is this the task of the poet as critic or the poet critic? Thank you.
It's been a long day, but I think we can take some questions for both and or Bob and Andy for debate or so, and then maybe pick it up again tomorrow morning. We start with Greg.
I want to take issue with some of your criticism.
Surprises me.
I feel, for example, Fritsch, you can see oblivious to a poetic process that's been constantly visual for 40 years now. And I wish that I was inside of an essay to provide a base with a little bit more accurate representation.
Well, I did, for the journal once, and I did for the essay
research.
Yeah.
I think in our atlas of the difficult world, notions of rich believe they're stable in any identities or any biological determinism. I mean, you read Marguerite, she, Olivia. I think her poem now is she found many of the notions she's subscribing to. I think with the case of Bly as well, when you read your essay, American Folk Critic since 1945 is similar. I felt that you didn't give why it was kind of bad representation because you let up to him and you used Bly as an example used of Bly that began from the reptilian brain. You used an answer in an interview, and you didn't know the question he was responding to or the context of the interview. And I think what he's saying, I brought in this little essay by Erskine, who was called Covering the Tree of the Mind. Actually, that at the time, what Bly was saying is actually based on scientific theory. He talks about the human brain consisting of several different brains that evolved at different times throughout the course of history. The outer layer of our brain is the cerebral cortex, goes on the seat of all things, the seat of all things human. But then he says there exists an earlier one, of the earlier brain, that is based on the function solely on sexual and procreative instinct, calls that the ancient command pole. So, again, we're using a 1994 conscious that the taxon that Bly said, I think, in 1971. I see that in here. I see what Bly is saying is based on certain scientific theory, as I just titled this about the reptilian brain. I'd like you to address those issues. The polar opposites, with the Heffer's Knight and Wallace Stevens, do you think that was in terms of their poetry? Do you think that in terms of how they're situated in Poland? Bethany Knight was a Vietnam veteran who was injured, was treated with drugs, and eventually became addicted to, and came out of this country to be arrested. He lived a life in poverty and other guys. Whereas Wallace Stevens was an insurance executive. So in that sense, I think, in terms of how they're situated in this country, they were polar. You were referring to the writing.
I was quoting Bly. He says two poles of North American culture.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think they do represent two poles.
So does he. My only point is that he thinks in polarities, and so I cited him in that sense. And he's not talking there about polarities of sobriety and addiction. So he's talking about poetry. I mean, but my only point there, and I said, first what I was interested in was the kind of algebraic pattern of Bly's thought, which is sort of black, white, conscious, unconscious, dreaming awake and so forth. And my sense is that it matters when we read someone like that, how the mind structures things, and then later at Fed try to feed in some content into it. But I mean, I don't think you don't want to deny that he thinks in these polarities, do you?
Well, I don't know. Are you designing a genre context of that? Can you identify polarity in that? What would be international?
Where would you like polarity? I mean, it's throughout his writing. And the quotations, there were no quotations from Iron John in the paper. They were all from the literary book, American Poetry, and so forth. But I mean, I don't think you can read five pages in blood without a contrast.
Yeah, I just you read the team author. I know Iron John. I remember the Plessy, especially the Plessy, because they have many stars talking about what they think about Crystal. That's sort of just your mind in through the novel. Whether you just create the means, I kind of like to dress through. Addressing a cultural dynamic that is part of the unique difference.
Yeah. The trend. Okay, let's just.
I threw a lot at you at once.
No, it's okay. It's just me. I mean, what you're asking me is, you know, where's the meat here? And I'm trying to.
You mentioned Ignatow versus somebody else in another polarity.
They're all versus.
Yeah. No, there are just millions of polarities. And that the same that I quoted him. I mean, in the other essay, not here. I refer to this reptilian brain thing, and it's in an interview there.
Right.
And here. I believe that what I'm referring to is an essay called Poetry in Three Brains.
Did you know that was my theory?
But wait, let me just deal with there are a couple of charges of abuse here, and I want to. You said the thing about the dates. Well, the thing about the dates, it's not as though. In his errant youth, he believed in the reptilian brain, and now he's a sage and has moved beyond that. This book is 1990. He reprints all this stuff, and the reptilian brain stuff is here still. So, you know, whenever he first got up, doesn't matter. This, you know, he believes in now. He dates this 1972-1989, which he's done with a lot of the essays. I think it'd be interesting actually to collate the original publication, so because he's clearly revised lots. It's interesting how he's revised some of these early essays, because he's fed in to essays where he publishes the date at the end information that occurred 20 years later. And so, I mean, what I take that to mean, what I take this book, American Poetry, Wellness and Domesticity, to mean is he's at peace with early blotting. He's able to take his own early critical writings, revise them, and republish them in 1990. May we? But he does this. He does this here. There's a difference between republishing an essay and not touching it and putting a date on it, and putting the date on there and then adding the date 1989, and doing a little bit of revision. That's different. And I think in the second case, you're claiming kind of unity of thought that you're disavowing to some extent in the preceding case. This is about science. I don't know how much it matters to me. I never meant to suggest that Bly dreamed up the reptilian mammalian stuff. I just think it's silly.
The claim he's making is so easy to dismiss because it sounds so outlandish. That's what I mean. That's what I want.
Yeah.
Okay, but is that
it's enough for me. That's enough for me. The fact that a scientist, you know, is interested in this, you know, doesn't really lend it any authority. I mean, I think the differences between your brain and the brain of a lizard are very great. Well, on the one hand, you do think it's literal, because I think that when you deduce the scientific authority, scientists are talking about literal truth, aren't they?
I mean, not the example of science, but a representation of evolutionary stages.
Okay, so it's just a metaphor in the scientist.
I'm not saying this makes it fact. I'm just saying that what I think what Bly is saying was based on certain scientific theories. It's a theory, not fact.
Well, if it's a theory, then I take it it's a literal theory, having to do with evolution. Right. And if it's a metaphor, then, you know, I can't take it seriously. Let me just say, finish up with the Rich thing. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying, and I quoted Rich as saying, I have a complex identity. Rich's identity she adds on terms of the complexity, you know, with succeeding books and so forth. She avows openly a sense of complex identity. What she is not able to do, I believe, is consistently live with that. That is to say, when she wants to write eloquently, she slips into a unitary notion of a homogenous identity in order to talk about wars of devastation, blah, 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 you know, instead of maintaining a sense of another level of discussion of politics of identity in terms of cultural hybridity, which she avows in, you know, I'm all these things, but she hasn't really absorbed it insofar as she can write eloquently about it. When she wishes to write eloquently, she backslides into ideas that are not to her credit, that are passé. That's my point. So when you say in poems and elsewhere she has come, I agree with you there. I agree with you there. I'm talking about when she writes in public for this audience, writes for this large public, and wants eloquence and pathos, she backslides intellectually.
Eric.
Yeah, I also wanted to join in this question of your characterization in such a different age. It occurred to me that there are, in fact, fairly similar statements or representations of poetry and the role of color between what you talked about in Bly and Rich and the kind of things we've been hearing about in all the same of poet critics so far in the conference. Bly's Reptile Brain, for example, it seems to me a kind of vulgarized and enjoyable comic because vulgarized version of the kind of intrusion of the other voice, the not I, the fourth tongue, so to speak, that we were talking about just in the previous presentation. It's blending Jurassic Park. And indeed, it seems to me what could present kind of vulgar popular culture versions of much that we've been talking about here. The dissident project that Professor Bob Placidi referred to in her earliest presentation, a kind of a poet critic version of Durango and Wild One. What are you rebelling against and what have you got? You recall, you know, if this kind of writing were what was the hegemonic discourse, I would be one to talk like a lawyer. That would be a brand of a lawyer. Who could have been a contender instead of a lawyer. I suppose what I want to ask is, are almost all poetry of the programmatic sort they're trying to advance it, poetic, particularly those trying to get a vision of the poetic or of poetry as that which does not fit conventional habits of thought, which is what you take as a blind, and very similar to what we've been talking about here. The poetic is that which does not fit discursive, irrational discourse, the discourse of techno-science and fiddling. Aren't presentations and essays and poetic criticism that take up and advance that cause always susceptible to criticism, that they are finally comforting, reassuring. We hear that as better than hearing these talks. Have we felt ourselves, I raise this question a lot, have we felt ourselves disrupted and thrown, or rather assured and comforted and feeling like, yes, we are part of a viable, resurgent, ongoing cultural practice, which is the pleasure that Rich and Bly supply to them many years. Different cultural practice and nostalgic one, as our practice is in 25 years. But not, you know, something that we can hide or easily criticize.
I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to answer it. I know I can't answer everything you said, but but actually, I did not, I felt moved by Nate's paper. I did not feel comforted by Nate's paper. And I'm not so happy following him because you know, and my question about that is, you know, reveal that to, I believe in the truth of what Nate is talking about. And there's, and Bly also was moved by Borges' notion of duende. And I believe in seeking intellectual difference. And that's one reason why I'd much rather read the criticism of poet critics than the criticism of my colleagues in English department, MLA and so forth. But do I think that, do I write being written? No, alas, I don't. And it's my loss. I'm not ironic about that. That I don't find it as an academic comforting to compare my own writing with the writing of poet critics. And very far from, I mean, I thought you were saying something, maybe you weren't saying, but I thought you were saying, you know, about the issue of simplification and so forth, and that it being endemic to this kind of criticism. Maybe, no.
No, not that it's endemic to it, but that what they are doing is, in some ways, yes, it's a simplified version, but I wanted to point out the congruences between.
Right, right. There are some congruences, I agree, but actually, I think that there is less of a pull towards simplification in a mode of criticism that is not governed by a sense that, which Charles amusingly satirized about everything leads to this point as you must necessarily see. And so this is what we teach, right? This is what we say to students, where's the argument, you know? And there are other ways of constructing prose than logical argument, but mostly not for me, you know, or if there are, you know, or I try to conceal them, you know, but poet critics, I think, have access to modes of writing that are not professional to, that are not professionally accredited by English departments, and allow them greater access to complications, and by complications I mean differences that can't be reconciled, reduced to some synthesis. They can leave them open, and the professors mostly can't. So I think that the pull for simplification is rather in PMLA than in the kinds of writing.
Well, let's do three more. Start with
I wanted to address Andy's assertion about Walter Benjamin as a reconciliator. And also, I'm sort of thinking of the connection with this question about why we were talking about it too. Because Walter Benjamin, correctly if I'm wrong, was talking about a state, a socialist state, in which things were controlled, in which the artist must function. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. I recently finished reading an article by Eva Hoffman, who visited Poland recently, after the fallout, after things that had happened, and attended a writer's meeting, the meeting of the writer's union, which was now allowed again to come together after the fall of communism. And she talked about this in terms that were just amazing, things that I did not know before. Writers in Poland and in those countries were considered very important people, writers, critics, or writer critics, as we're talking about here. And they were paid a very good salary, and they were given many, many perks. They were allowed special clubs and got special foods that other people didn't get, and were paid by the page. Okay, this was the system on the communist, and I'm going to do that for your salary. But you were honored. The writing must have been good, excellent. You were not paid if the writing somehow was not good. I don't know what was the judgment. writing was a big honorable task. And they were trying to explain to the writers now, the meeting, that as they are coming under capitalism now, the system is going to be different. And the writers, one of the men said, well, it was astounding. He said, well, this means that poor writing, terrible writing, might get a lot more money than good writing. Things that sell. And basically, this is, isn't this what we're talking about here? Robert Ryan, who sells. He's like, I don't know how good he is. I don't have to judge him very high on my list of writer critics. I've read him, and I don't judge him there. But obviously, he is meeting some market need, and this is the society in which we live. And can we deny that this is important? This is the society in which we live. Selling. You are meeting a popular, cultural, momentary, or whatever desire. That's a different thing. We're talking about excellence in writing or excellence in the poll critic.
Yes, it is. It's a different thing, but it's the job of intellectuals and stuff to say it's a different thing, and the loss is theirs. That's our job. And, I mean, but the other thing is that Adrienne Rich. I mean, Bly is, as I said, anti-intellectual. Adrienne Rich is not, and so that to criticize Adrienne Rich, I mean to be criticizing people whom I esteem highly and who admire her and with whom I work and so forth. So it's not really in her case. It's, I mean, what I'm criticizing in her, is when she nods and when she's
Why
is it different things entirely? Yeah, I want to comment a little bit on the Polish thing, and maybe Andy does too. I think one thing that's a little misleading is that what people were. I don't know much about Poland, but I know about East Germany, where the writers' union and so forth, and so I'm presuming that there's similarity. And the payment that East German writers received, which they have now lost, is not a payment in cash. It's a payment in importance and readership. This is quite relevant. It was not at all uncommon for a book of poems, even a first book of poems, in East Germany to go through 10,000 copies, and the copies would be sold within 3 weeks by a relatively unknown poet. And this would be in a country of 17 million, that is a country with a population less than one-tenth of the population of the U.S. And the point was not that the poets lived high on the hog. They did not. They made a lot of money. The point was they were read. And mostly read. That's the point I want to make, is that they had a sense of consequence, which we in the West we envy, and you often see these ridiculous things. At least people care about the sense of it, but that's what has been lost. At the same time, yes, a livelihood, is called into question. But it's the sense of importance, and that is what I'm trying to talk about. What is the importance that the public attaches to poets like Rich?
Well, I don't know. It's the poetry and the attributes that we talked about, the writers and what's going on, important. And I wonder if these are the ones that you're talking about. There was any room for dissonant writers in this context. I mean, what kind of poems would be produced?
There was room for dissonant writers, it's a complicated situation, but there were professional organizations which you had to be accredited to get in. You had to publish two books to get in, and you had to have two people vouch for you to get in, sponsor you to get in. And they talked as in your representation. They talked quite boldly in our terms of the aesthetic value. There had to be high aesthetic value. And let's see what. I don't know how much of this is worth going into, but there was a paper shortage in the Warsaw Pact countries, and so writers would be told, you know, don't rush it. And they were given, and because we've got a paper shortage anyway, you can't publish the book until 2 years from now. Take your time. And so many writers and scholars feel that in East Germany, among literary scholars, they say what's going to be lost is a mode of literary scholarship that rests upon patient, sustained historical research. Which we had to do because we had a paper shortage in the East, and we were supported. Our rent was paid, and so forth. I mean, they were supported a low standard of living by Western terms, but they were supported, had security, and less was expected of them in terms of productivity, and something similar for artists and for novelists. And the point would then be made: we had time to revise and revise again, whereas Poundian terms in the West, you know, you had to write and write quickly and so forth. So the aesthetic value is sort of encouraged by this paper shortage, pen is too light when you chisel and write. You know, it's if you're writing in stone, you'll think a little longer about what you're going to write.
And the amazing thing now, also, especially what is selling there, what is selling there so tremendously is all of these how-to books that the American published, the personal improvement and how to do this and how to do that. They're selling like wildfire.
On the subject of dissidents, I wanted to say that there is a range of, I mean, some of you probably have read the essay a few years ago in New York by Jane Kramer on Sasha Anderson and the two big scandals in East Germany. One was Christa Wolf's publication, who is a critical writer but is supported nonetheless of the state, her publication of a story she wrote in 1979 and didn't publish until 1989 called What Remains, published in English now. She was criticized for not having the courage to publish it when she wrote it, and the story says, shows how she was under surveillance by the secret police and so on. And the big scandal was this critical writer lacked the courage in 79 to publish this book when it would have hurt her. Now instead she waits till 1989 when there's no risk, and then she publishes it and says to the world, look, they were so crazy, they had even me under surveillance, and you all know I actually supported the state. And so it was seen as an act of ingratiation to the West, and the moment when she's been trying to make the transition to being a Western writer. So there's a really big criticism, big controversy about that. And the second one was that the Allen Ginsberg figure, the avant-garde there, Sasha Anderson, the organizer, the everybody's friend person, was 15 years an informant for the Stasi. So there's a range of dissidents allowed. Christa Wolf was critical of the East German government. You can read it in Cassandra, you can read it in any of her books. And Sasha Anderson organized an avant-garde scene that depended upon illicit publications, illicit poetry readings. He smuggled canvases of East German painters out of the country to sell in the West. All these things, subsidized by the Stasi, organized by the Stasi. And the journal, there was a journal called Ari Asenkabri, which was edited by a poet who devoted the journal to bringing in French theory into the East German literary scene. The theory there had very little effect on the academic world. It came in through the writers. It's really quite a different situation, quite interesting. And the magazine was subsidized, literally subsidized, issue by the Stasi. Chudlinski, Brenner Chudlinski, was the editor of the magazine, and he too was an informant for the Stasi. And so the Stasi was literally subsidizing the popularization of Deleuze and Guattari, of Lyotard, Roland Barthes, and so forth. So, I mean, what possible use they could have seen in this is something to discuss. And so a wide range of managed dissidents was and the more professional structures they had, writers, unions, research institutions, the easier it was to manage, to steer.
We'll wait till tomorrow and see you tomorrow.
We'll see you all tomorrow morning.